the MadTech Podcast, news of the week in ad tech and marketing tech, brought to you by ExchangeWire.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this week's edition of ExchangeWire's Mad Tech Podcast. I'm Rachel Smith, and I'm the CEO of ExchangeWire, and I'm delighted to be joined by my two guests today. Firstly, very special guest, Baena Black, who is Global Director, Sustainability and Impact for RGA, and based at the moment, today at least anyway, in New York. Hi, Baena.
Hi, so happy to be here. Thank you for having me, Rachel.
It's absolutely our pleasure. And in addition to Baena, we have Matt Broughton, who is editor at ExchangeWire. You know what, Matt? I forgot your job title.
Research lead, but editor. I do editing. I do that kind of stuff. So all good.
Excellent. And of course, the reason that, you know, I'm so loopy today is because I've just found out that it's World Oceans Day, which is super exciting news. Thanks very much to Baena for being able to tell us all about that. And that actually is very handy because we've got a list of really interesting news stories that fall underneath, in part, the sustainability agenda to chat about on this week's podcast. So I'm going to dive straight into news story number one, which is focusing on the degree to which ESG is becoming critical to the agency selection process. So this is an interesting piece of news that's come out this week, which I feel also connects to some news that's been coming out in the last couple of weeks about the agency pitch process in general. So there's been quite a bit in the news around how arduous the agency pitch process can be. But this particular story is focusing on how important ESG has become in the process of agencies pitching for business. So for those who might not be aware, I'm sure everybody is, ESG stands for Environmental, Social and Governance. And the principle behind the acronym is that a business or an organization gives suitable attention to each of those three areas of responsibility and can very clearly state what they do to uphold those principles, both in the way that they run their own company and the way that they're executing their business on behalf of their clients, customers, partners, whomever it might be that they serve. So what this news story tells us is that brands are increasingly asking agencies to prove their sustainability credentials at the point of pitching. So particularly focusing on reducing carbon emissions, efforts to reach net zero and offsetting strategies. And this is a trend that follows a shift in perception in a general sense of environmental, social and governance principles. So moving them from being merely procedural to instead high priorities from a practical point of view for lots of organizations and corporations. But interestingly, this focus is going both ways. So we're also seeing accounts of agencies pushing back perhaps on the possibility to pitch for client business if they're looking at clients that don't uphold some of these ESG principles, and in particular clients that aren't focused on trying to achieve some form of tackling climate issues, whether that's reducing their own carbon footprint or the impact that they may be having in terms of their supply chain. So I found that particular angle to this story really interesting. But my question to you in the first instance, Baena, is how is the pitching process being changed as a result of ESG? And has sustainability become a bit of a deal breaker when we're talking about pitching for new business from an agency point of view?
Yeah, I love this question, Rachel. Thank you. So I'd say that, you know, it is crucial. We've seen a significant amount of RFIs and RFPs come through that ask us very specifically about our goals, our goals, and not just our goals, but our initiatives, what we're actually doing in this space. And so I wouldn't say that it's necessarily a deal breaker yet, but I would say that we have seen like an uptick in how many questions we've been getting around our impact and what we're doing. And a really good example of this is a few weeks ago, there was an announcement that came out about Patagonia and that they were looking for a B Corp agency to take on their EMEA marketing. And so naturally so, especially with a brand like Patagonia, we would expect something like that. But then when we actually break that requests down, there are only 454 ad agencies that are B Corp certified in the first place, and probably two handfuls of them can actually take on that level of work in the first place. It is incredibly difficult to obtain a B Corp certificate, but it's necessary. And I love that. And I sent that article to a few of our executives over at RGA because it's a great example of the direction that I feel like we're moving into.
And that's super interesting, right? Because as you've said, it's really quite difficult to attain B Corp status and the credentials necessary. So do you have a point of view, Beena, on what agencies will need to do in order to get themselves prepared for that if they're considering something like trying to attain B Corp status?
Oh, my goodness. Yes, I do. This is a topic that's very near and dear to my heart because I have been trying to get us on board with becoming a B Corp for a number of years. And it is difficult. And what I'd say is that you have to have buy-in from the top. Yes, there's a desire to have buy-in and support from employees, but you have to have buy-in from the top because it encompasses the assessment. The B Corp assessment encompasses so many different areas of the company, and it's sensitive information as well. And so I'd say like making a very strong case and showing examples, for instance, Wieden and Kennedy, they just announced not long ago, a couple of weeks ago as well. There's a lot of announcements coming out, but I think it's timely because we're rolling into Cannes soon. But Wieden and Kennedy just announced that their whole entire network is a B Corp. But the reason why they were able to do that as well is because they're independent. And so I'd say like in preparation, even prior to starting the process, is finding out what their legal status is and if they can even change it in the first place. Because I was just speaking with our sustainability team over at IPG, which is our parent company, about this very issue. Because there are a number of us in the network who want to obtain this certificate, but it's incredibly difficult. So in short, I'd say getting buy-in from the top and specifically like the CEO and also checking with their legal department to see if they can even change their bylaws in the first place before they go down that road. But also just like being very honest and looking at like, where are they, you know, and if it's something that they are actually committed to doing, because it takes quite a lot of time to one, even finish the assessment and get your score in the first place. And then once you get it, to actually implement some of the changes if they don't score high enough. And so you're in it for the long haul. You know, this is not a short thing at all. So momentum is my number one recommendation too.
I mean, we could have a whole separate podcast on that topic alone. There's so many questions that I have associated with that, because you know I'm really intrigued by the notion of B Corp status, not just for advertising agencies, but also for lots of brands and other companies. But in the world of advertising and marketing tech, what about publishing organizations and media groups? You know, it's getting to grips with the requirements, depending on what type of business you are, is potentially vast, right? And like you said, very senior buy-in and leadership is needed, because this is a serious commitment, a serious long-term commitment. And there's so many little subtopics we could dive into. But for the next couple of minutes at least, Matt, let me come to you and ask you, because you have indeed here at ExchangeWire contributed to a lot of the content that we've produced around the impact that the industry, advertising marketing industry, is having on environmental sustainability. Can you foresee a moment where this becomes a deal breaker requirement between agencies and brands? What's your perspective?
Yeah, I don't think it's at that moment yet, but I think there's definitely, again, momentum towards that point. And I think it comes down to that core accountability element. And I think the shift towards making sustainability more of a core element of company performance targets rather than just a you know, almost a nice to have messaging aspect, particularly for, you know, the scaled public companies. That's going to affect pretty much every single supply chain. And obviously advertising is no exception there. We ran a piece of research last year at ExchangeWire, and it suggests that the majority of the European market requires partners to at least report carbon emissions. And by the end of 2024, encouragingly, France and Germany, the majority of advertising budgets will be allocated to carbon neutral partners, according to the data. So it's definitely shifting that way. Like I say, I don't necessarily think it's quite there yet, but the momentum certainly seems to be heading in that direction.
Yeah, which is fantastic, right? My next question to both of you was going to be, you know, if we were to mentally at least row back, say, I don't know, a couple of years, maybe just before the pandemic around 2019, you know, it didn't feel as though this was anywhere near to the same level of, you know, priority on the agenda that it is now. But I guess, you know, we can't have gotten to where we are today from out of nowhere. So I'm interested in both of your perspectives on this, but Baina, let me come to you first, especially as a champion in this area. Do you feel as though momentum has just suddenly picked up? And, you know, if so, what's fueled that? And if we were having this conversation back in 2019, do you feel as though you would have been really sort of banging the drum and not necessarily being paid as much attention to as you might be today?
You know, this is such an interesting question, and especially the time frame that you said, right, 2019, because one of the main things that happened in the beginning of 2020 that I feel like really sparked this conversation, and it was Larry Fink's letter to the CEO that he puts out, or letter to his CEOs that he puts out every year. And this was really significant because he was cracking down, and just for context of who he is, he's the chairman of BlackRock, which has like the largest investments in the world. And I really applauded him for these letters because it sets the tone for the rest of the year. So that happened, and the letter came out in January of 2020. And it really outlined that that BlackRock was going to take like legal action towards the companies, especially that they invest in, that aren't focused on ESG topics, and specifically with climate change. And so I started to notice that there were a lot of articles that came out around the same time that the letter came out, because he gives his CEOs a heads up, right, that he's going to make this announcement saying like, we're planning to be like carbon neutral, or, you know, carbon zero by this point, da 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 da. And it was just like, huh, that's interesting, right? Because it's like, if you don't do this, then he's threatening to take legal action and also not invest in you all. And so I'd say that in addition to the pandemic, obviously, we have noticed a lot more attention on this topic. And I was listening to another podcast a few weeks ago that was kind of blaming ESG for the economic downturn too. And some people were saying like, if companies weren't focused on this, then maybe we wouldn't be in this position, which is absolutely absurd and ridiculous. But to more directly answer your question, I think that, you know, it has made the recent events in the past few years, and the pandemic especially, has made it easier to talk about these things because of the rules and regulations that have been put in place very recently that require companies to report certain data and information. It's still a challenge, you know, like I think all of us can agree on that, but it is a bit more easier, especially as people are starting to wake up and there are more current and climate crises that are happening. For instance, I'm in New York right now, and we're experiencing like orange skies because of the Canadian wildfires. Mm. Like, it's like every day it's something else. Like, how can you not pay attention to this? And also, younger generations are really demanding employers to care about ESG. So I'd say it is easier right now, but we have a long way to go.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And your point about the wildfires, when I was reading some stuff this week about what's going on in Canada, it was reminding me of Australia in the summer of 2018 to 19, where we had terrible wildfires as well, and that smoke was, you know, drifting across the Pacific Ocean down to New Zealand and stuff, and it was just crazy. And then, another 12 months later, when by the time the pandemic had started to get going or kicked off, actually, sorry, that was summer 2019, 2020. The summer later, 2020, 2021, there was record floods and, you know, crazy cold temperatures, which of the likes of which Australia hasn't experienced for years in the summer months. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it makes me reflect on some of the points that you had there. And so question for you, Matt, the climate crisis isn't new. Why have we been able to, you know, get people's attention about it now? Obviously, Baena gave some really good insights into that. But from your point of view, for example, could you have imagined writing the, you know, a research report focusing on this topic in the industry 3 years ago?
Not unless it was by a very, very forward-thinking company at the time. And to me, it's just such a shame that it takes a letter from a, you know, obviously very prominent investor, but it takes that to force change rather than the obvious environmental disasters that have been taking place over the last 5 to 10 years. And obviously, as you said, Rachel, the pressure from younger generations, particularly, who really want to see meaningful and tangible impact. And it's almost a sad state that it has to be from a letter from an investor that drives that. But I think now that the momentum is going that way, it's important to capitalize on it. And we've seen great things in the industry with companies starting to measure and therefore be able to drive other companies to react accordingly to that. I think at the moment it does still tend towards that more sort of carbon emissions aspect of sustainability. You know, I haven't seen yet a programmatic ad company talking about how they're going to measure water usage around their company's impacts or their, you know, general other supply chains. That will come in time, I feel. But yeah, I think there is a long way to go.
Brings me on to the next topic, actually, which is focusing on, again, some new stories coming out in the press this week about a higher degree of authenticity required for diversity and inclusivity to succeed. So, you know, it's kind of it's another strand of ESG principles, which is the impact that you're having on, you know, on society and on social interaction and cohesion, both within your company and externally. And I feel as though diversity and equalities, inclusivity has been something, again, that the industry has been far more focused on, I would say, in the last, say, 3 to 4 years than it was when I first joined the industry nearly 12 years ago now. And authenticity feels to me like such a critical element of this. I think a lot of what's come out in this particular news story, which is a bit of a snapshot of how people feel about DEI in the context of workplace culture, relates quite nicely to what we were just talking about with respect to sustainability. So efforts to integrate DEI into workplace culture are being undermined because of this lack of authenticity. According to communication professionals, DEI practitioner Sheila Callahan, employers misunderstand the scope of DEI and the benefits of incorporating it into their business, causing them to view it as a tokenistic program. So the article notes that leadership is one of the things that's required in order to make some change, but also bringing some diverse talents and expertise into the boardroom, having the opportunity or creating the opportunity to listen to employees' experiences and not just the experiences that we can share in the workplace, but understanding their lives and what that, you know, what perspective that brings to the way that we all interact together. And there's also an element and a very important thread here around accountability that we need to not just similarly to, you know, sustainability and the industry's impact on the climate, we need to not just measure what we're currently doing, but set ourselves actually some targets and some goals for how we're going to improve and how we're going to change things. So My question, I'm going to come to you first, Matt, on this, is what progress has been made towards embedding diversity, inclusion and equality into the industry, the advertising industry, and what more needs to be done? Again, separate whole podcast on this, but high level chit chat topic. Matt, what's your point of view on this?
Yeah, I think it contrasts really nicely with the previous story in that obviously we've talked that there's momentum going on, particularly when it comes to carbon emissions, but I don't think that's necessarily the case here. And I think that accountability piece, that is absolutely the key. How that works out in practice, I think that does need to be an industry-wide conversation. Obviously, what we've seen in terms of the sustainability around carbon emissions is that it's almost like a due diligence process. And I wonder whether we could do something similar here in that an industry-approved sort of standard survey, for example, is completed, which allows comparisons to be made in how the, you know, differences in these policies, how they're actually, you know, bearing fruit. Because at the moment, I think that authenticity piece, because it's just that much more difficult to measure, I think it's not necessarily being able to be acted upon as yet. I completely agree with Callaghan in the article that people-based strategies are the absolute key here as well. It can't just be line items. It can't just be, you know, fully focusing on that more sort of quantifiable side of things. It needs to be based on people and how they're, you know, feeling with regards to these policies. So yeah, it's a difficult one in how that kind of all ties together at the end. But I think, you know, it's a conversation that's obviously hugely important and one that just continues and is absolutely necessary to be at the forefront.
Yeah, massively. And I think we've got, I feel like I've got a particular experience of it during my time working in the advertising industry compared with my time of working in the public sector, which was the career I had before I started working in advertising. So I'll say a bit about that in a minute. Baina, please let us know what you think about this article.
Oof, this is one that I feel really passionate about because it brings up so many important points, right? And so what does authenticity in this space mean in the first place, right? And I think that as it relates to the article previously, first of all, there are 450 different ways to define sustainability. For advertising specifically, according to the Sustainability Accounting Standards Board, or SASB, our top three that we should be focusing on are data privacy and protection, workforce diversity and inclusion, and advertising integrity. And so the reason why I like lay that foundation or grounding is because this is an area that we should be focusing on, right? And so what does it mean to be inclusive and to hear directly from the people who are part of the solution and of the challenges that you're trying to solve? It blows my mind when I think about specifically the UK, because one thing that I didn't realize is that like strategy was like created between like Oxford and Cambridge, and culture was looked at from a very academic perspective, you know, like studied. And I'm just like, this is crazy, because like I literally live the experience of an Afro-Latina woman living in the US and Brazil and other places. So why would you not come to me instead of, you know, a study or something else that's not as authentic? Also, you know, I was thinking about this article and again, going back to like, what does authenticity really mean? And for me, I think about some of the radical changes and statements that need to be made and followed up and held accountable for, but who's going to hold these agencies accountable? There's a organization called Agency DEI that since 2020 has been tracking over 400 agency statements around their commitments to DEI. And every year they put out a new report about where those companies are, you know, because I think that we are going back to more performative measures. I think that the holding companies need to hold the agencies more accountable, and from a financial perspective as well. These are conversations that I've been having recently with our parent company, because if they don't hold us accountable to it, then it withers away until the next shooting or the next protest happens or the next big crisis. And it's like, keep that same energy. Like, don't, you know, wither away just because it's not hot in the news at the time, which is really unfortunate. And I think also going back to the authenticity piece, it's like following through from the beginning to the end, you know, from the time of creating the work to the award show, you know, and I love that I've seen more authenticity in who's, you know, up there accepting the award. It's the subjects that we're talking about, or we're including them more. We did a case study for one of the projects I work on for Founderland, and the voiceover for the talent was one of the founders from the organization. You know, that's authenticity. That's making sure that we're putting our money where our mouths are and our efforts as well.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, there's so many different threads to this particular conversation and also to this particular article, right? There is, you know, if we sort of cut to the core of it, which is this particular article, which is about trying to establish some sort of authenticity in these DEI efforts, then that definitely causes us to think about the things that we've discussed, which is, you know, how do you establish what your level of progress is right now? And how do you then, you know, set your sights on where you want to be? How do you get there and who holds you accountable for that? But then there is also the element of it where I think that actually there's a lot of things happening in the advertising and marketing industry that is definitely progressing our collective approach towards DEI, but it's sort of happening in bits and pieces. I'm not saying piecemeal, as though there isn't a significant volume of activity happening. There is, but it's sort of just happening anyway, I suppose, is what I want to say. Now, there's maybe a good side to that, which is it helps to grow a little bit the momentum that we're talking about and the energy that you just mentioned as well, Beena. But it's also that there needs to be something more than that. We need to have some sort of more collective understanding of this, I think. And I'm not quite sure how you get there. So if I think about, as I mentioned earlier on, a previous career that I had in the public sector, it was very sort of target driven. So we talked about what our workforce looked like. We talked about what, because we were talking about DEI across the board, obviously, we talked about, you know, what adjustments were maybe needed to accommodate, you know, other people in the workplace, what type of work we were offering, and whether our workforce also reflected the communities that we serve from the point of view of public services, those sorts of things. And there's lots of specific targets attached to that. And what I thought was good about that is that it did mean that you felt like you were aiming towards something and you could track some progress getting there, and that there were some people, some individuals and some teams and some parts of the organization and some leaders at the top of the organization that were responsible for all of that. That was all great. But does it equal, you know, wide scale, significant societal change? I'm not sure. You know, I felt like maybe it was at the time, but, you know, this was in another career that I had like 15, 20 years ago. And here we are talking about it today in the context of marketing and advertising. And I still feel that we have a long way to go in this industry in and of itself, and then a long way to go as a collection of societies, as a planet, basically. So, you know, where do you start? How do you tackle this? And I don't know.
I think that, you know, going back to what you were saying, I think that there should be some sort of standards, right? And understanding of like, where are we trying to go? And that we're all on the same page about it. And even though we've been in this conversation deeply for the past 3 years, I still feel like we don't have that. You know, especially with the wavering support. So one of the reasons why I mentioned SASB is because it's a standards board, right? Mm. And personally, like, I have not seen a standards for DEI to the point where everyone is on board. And I think that there are a lot of not just agencies, but organizations and entities in general who want to be the first or come out with something new and fresh that is the standard or that's the direction. But if we could all just kind of come together and get on the same page about senior leadership and the representation that we need there, about the health and wellness of our employees and like what needs to happen there. We focus, the Make Good for Businesses program that I run focuses very specifically on the racial wealth gap and providing our creative services to BIPOC small business and nonprofits for free, because that's an area that we do every day for our clients. So we can do that as well. So it's kind of like a, you know, these at the top, what needs to happen, what needs to happen across the board for employees, what needs to happen based off of your region of the world that you're in, because there are very specific challenges within each region. Obviously, we know this. And then also like what your company themselves, like what your specialties are and how you can, you know, reach back to local organizations. And also, I'd say getting more organizations who have been doing this work for years involved. Yeah. I want to see more of that, because again, why reinvent the wheel or, you know, rush into a study group? Partner with an organization that is an expert in this area.
Yeah. What's really interesting about that, sorry, I'll let you speak in a minute, Matt, is that I was just having a briefing call actually in the lead up to our annual ATS conference in London, which we're hosting here in London next week on Tuesday and Wednesday. And I was having a briefing call in preparation for a panel session that we're having focusing on media responsibility. So how do we take responsibility across the industry for where media dollars are directed, and what does that look like from an efficiency point of view, but also from a sustainability point of view and from a diversity point of view? And one of the panelists that I was chatting with was talking about how at their agency, one of the things they work really closely with clients to do is, you know, in addition to obviously understanding exactly what they're trying to do with their marketing and advertising campaigns, is make them aware of, you know, where they'd like those ad dollars to go in terms of what type of media businesses they want to support. So would they like to support with their advertising spend media businesses that focus, you know, that are maybe minority owned and that are very community grassroots led and are doing, you know, very specific things and reinvesting back into local communities? Or maybe they want to support media companies that have got a big climate change and, you know, environmental sustainability agenda. And, you know, I think that's a really practical example of how, you know, this can be a thread that runs through the entire industry, just as you've described there, Baina. It's about the organization, the leadership, the staff, their day-to-day lives, and the output of the work that we're doing, you know, like you said, from creating the campaign to receiving the award and thinking about, you know, every element of that part of the advertising value chain. Matt, let me take a breather and come to you.
Yeah, I completely agree with the pair of you. I think it does have to be looked at that more, you know, on that more holistic level, so that action can then be taken. And I think, yeah, that collaborative approach is going to be hugely key to that. Obviously, bringing companies that are living that, breathing that, rather than, you know, trying to start from scratch where you're not necessarily going to be as effective.
Yeah, yeah. Much work to do. I'm going to move us on to the third news story for today, which is focusing on the content strategies of agencies in a general sense, but specifically looking at some recent reports that are telling us that agencies are thinking long and hard about the volume and the quality of the content that they're putting out there in the name of their clients and in order to support their clients' ambitions with respect to marketing and advertising. So as you know, we're all consuming a lot more content than we probably ever have before, certainly in our lifetimes and as a population, more than we ever have before in history. And I think from an agency point of view, the challenge is very much thinking about quality and cut through. So how can they be best representing their clients' needs in terms of what type of content they're pulling together, what channels they're using to promote that content, and what actual results they're getting for their clients as a result of that. So we know that, for example, in the US during 2022, content consumption was up by 1.9% across all devices. So mostly that includes smart TVs, gaming consoles, and obviously any other internet connected device, such as your mobile phone. And that amounts to about 8 hours and 14 minutes a day. That's a long time to be spending consuming content, right? And, you know, that's a day of work, and presumably some of that goes into your working day. But, you know, if you're also spending, if that's a day on the weekend and you're spending a lot of time gaming, or you're spending a lot of time on your phone or a time in front of the telly, that's a hell of a lot of content, right? So the focus here from a strategic point of view, this article argues, needs to be steering away from churning out a high volume of potential of content, which can potentially be perceived by consumers as well as less meaningful, and rather reflecting more on the ethical implications of the quality of the content that you're producing. So not just also about the quality, but I guess about where it's actually directing clients and consumers. There's also an element to these reports that suggests that consumers will vote with their feet. So if they feel as though the content that they're consuming either isn't, you know, morally, you know, ethical, or it isn't relevant to them, or they're getting bombarded by a high volume of content, they're far more likely to be put off by the messages that marketers are trying to send them, or by the brands that they're representing. So there is an impetus for agencies to care deeply about this. So first question over to you, Baina. How do you in your agency, or how do your colleagues as well across the agency, how do you approach trying to stand out in such a crowded digital marketplace? What do you do? How do you tackle this challenge together with your clients?
Yeah, I think that, you know, I love the thread of all the articles that we've been discussing. And there's an undertone of like well-being that is, you know, that we're talking about as well. And the reason why I bring that up is because I think about what is happening at like the global level in society. We have been reflecting on like the Great Realization and what happened in 2020, and us thinking about what do people really care about the most? Where do they want to spend their time with their loved ones, with family? And if they're going to be on their screens and on their phones, like, what do they need to see that supports this new lifestyle that they've decided to carve out for them? And so I'd say that what we've been doing is being a lot more strategic and mindful about that, and people wanting to spend more time with their families. So the well-being of our consumers and also the content creators and influencers that we work with is very important as well. And I've been reading a couple of articles about influencer burnout and how some of them are actually going back into the workforce because they feel so much pressure to share their lives and to create such a high volume of content in the first place. And so I think that because of the pandemic, we have just been a lot more mindful about people's time and energy and efforts and their well-being and where they want to focus their energy. And so less is more in this case. I remember watching a spot that just came out from IKEA that was so brilliant. And it showed like the IKEA products and actually what was happening in real life. The camera panned out to show like a father holding his son on his lap, but there was a stool in the background or a high chair in the background. It's just kind of like, that's really meaningful. And so I'm seeing a trend of more meaningful and work that resonates to people's everyday lives to give them more time to spend with their loved ones.
And I mean, that's a really interesting, a really essential kind of angle to this story as well, is that I think that together with, you know, consumers potentially feeling sort of saturated and bombarded by content is also the awareness, growing awareness that I think many people have of spending too much time consuming either content that's not relevant or not the best quality or not really, you know, not really the content that they want to be consuming. I think people are becoming all the more aware of the fact that we can all disappear down, you know, doom scrolling holes and lose hours of our lives and think, what was I doing that for when I could have been doing something else, right? And so that links not just to the well-being of, you know, us as individuals, but also that sense that you mentioned, Bina, of wanting to spend more time with others. You know, we don't live our lives in isolation of one another, even if we're at home gaming on the weekends because that's one of our hobbies and it's something we really love to do. Matt, you can speak to that because I know you're a massive gamer. Painting some reclaimed furniture that we've put together on the weekend, which is also something else I know Matt likes to do with his spare time.
I'm loving these hobbies, Matt.
They're good, aren't they? They're good. Yeah.
Keeps me busy.
Got some solid hobbies. But, you know, even when you're enjoying those hobbies, you're not actually really doing that in isolation, are you? You know, you're gaming with others invariably, or you're able to discuss how much you enjoy that with other people that you know really like it. You're making furniture to enjoy usually with others, or, you know, to, you know, for some other kind of creative outlet and ambition. And, you know, so we therefore want to, I think this sort of internet-enabled world that we've gotten ourselves into, whilst it's got so many fabulous elements to it, the downside is that it somehow sort of, if we're talking about the impact it can have on our mental health, constricts us down into this being that's kind of scrolling through our phones. And I don't think anyone wants to be like that. Children don't want to be like that. Teenagers don't want to be like that. Adults don't want to be like that. What you want is for it to enhance your life rather than detract, right? Matt, tell me what you think.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think in terms of just how the, you know, in terms of, online content, it's as much as there's so much more, there's also so much more choice. And I think that's what, in terms of bringing it back to the advertising angle, I think that's where it's become, you know, advertisers are a lot more aware that users will turn away from intrusive or low quality advertising because they know they can get content elsewhere that doesn't, you know, they feel isn't intruding on them or tracking them or is not the quality they want to see. And I think that's probably why we've seen a much greater focus on, you know, obviously as alongside, you know, the privacy legislation element of it, but there's been a much greater focus on the context at which you're serving advertising and attention it's getting rather than just, yes, I've served this person an ad. That's fulfilled everything. It's got to the point now, thankfully, where it's, you know, it needs to be a lot more relevant to the content and it needs to be a lot more in line with that. And I think in terms of the technology we have available to us, in terms of things like dynamic creative optimization and that, you know, newer age contextual technology where you're able to really look into what the audience really wants to engage with, what advertising is working really well against that content, to not just be, this is an ad served against this content. This is actually enhancing it. This is making it even better. And I love that IKEA example as well. It's a, you know, really interesting campaign and I love to see that kind of thing. So I think in terms of, you know, how content is really exploding, I think it's a case of we really have the opportunity to make it almost a renaissance in the advertising that served against it. And I think we do have the technology available to help us do that. Obviously, yes, there will be, you know, still lower quality elements of advertising out there. But again, I think consumers, with the amount of content that is available, they will see that and vote with their feet rather than, you know, back in the days of, you know, three or four channels on your TV, you've only got a very limited amount of choice. Whereas now, so many different channels, so many different sub-channels within that. So yeah, I think that choice element will only help to serve as a renaissance for advertising.
Yeah, I hope so.
Advertising. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, not at all. It's good, isn't it? Because it's also really a good point around choice, right? Because I think the choice has become overwhelming for lots of consumers. So there has to be another angle to that. And it would be really great that those choices and those options lead to this renaissance in advertising that gets us all to think about it in a different way through a different lens. I also like the idea that, you know, less is more. And I wonder, though, if, you know, if marketers within brands can resist the temptation to keep going for more rather than less. Right? Because I guess the challenge here is better quality, but less of it, you know, lower the quantity, improve the quality, right?
And also, you know, when we think about where we are in the economy right now, I think that they will have to adhere and align with less is more, because I imagine this has already been happening, that the marketing budgets have been decreasing. And so you do have to be a lot more intentional about the content being put out, because there will be less of it, you know, and how can what we are creating, how can it be impactful and meaningful and get the results that we're looking for?
Yeah, absolutely. Right. I'm going to move us on to the final part of the podcast and ask you a few questions, Beena, about what you are up to at RGA. We've already had a little bit of insight because these stories have been very much focused on some things that you're particularly passionate about. But tell us a bit about your role there. In particular, I'm interested in the fact that it's global. So maybe you can say a little bit about how you work across different regions and what that's like for you.
Yes. And, you know, I love the global part of my title. It's probably my favorite, to be honest. So I'm the Global Director of Sustainability and Impact, and I oversee a program called Make Good, which is our Sustainability, Impact, and Volunteer program. And it's the first of its kind at RGA. Our flagship program is Make Good for Businesses, which provides Black, Indigenous, Latine, and Asian small businesses and nonprofits our creative services for free for them. And I work mainly with our LATAM offices. So we have an office in Brazil and in Argentina. I also work with our EMEA offices, so Berlin and London, and Australia as well. And of course, the US. I kind of always forget about the US sometimes. What I love about my role and the work that we do is I get such great insights on some of the key challenges that the regions are facing as it relates to just ESG in general, right? And by working with these small businesses and nonprofits, we really have an opportunity to elevate their messages. Like I was talking about earlier, about partnering with organizations who have been doing this work for years. And so that's what we get to do through the Make Good for Businesses program, is to elevate their messages and help them get it out. And I'd say that our most successful partnership has been with Founderland, a nonprofit based in Berlin, who is the only nonprofit in Europe that helps women of color on their entrepreneurial journeys. And so I thoroughly enjoy my job and what I get to do every day.
It sounds like an awesome job, I have to say. I bet you've met some fantastic people, some really fascinating people, and some really passionate founders of businesses and people that work in small entrepreneurial businesses. What do you... you mentioned that you get, you know, the privilege of getting some insight into what the challenges are from region to region. Are there any standouts there?
Yeah, you know, the one project that I'd say really helped me to understand the depths of some of these challenges would be the Black in Ukraine project that we worked on last year and this year. And so, as everyone knows, like on February 24th of last year, Russia invaded Ukraine. And there's been a lot of aid for Ukraine and Ukrainians, but there was a subgroup that was being ignored, and it was people of African descent. And what I found out through Twitter, actually, because I just so happened to be on Twitter, I found out that a lot of people of African descent were being turned away from the borders. They were facing a lot of discrimination and hate and violence even, and were having a hard time fleeing and accessing some of these resources. that other white Ukrainians were privileged to. And so we partner with an organization that was actually, they weren't even an organization, to be honest. They were a collective. It was three Black women who were from London who got together to raise funds. And so we created an editorial NFT to help them raise some funds, and overall, in collection with their efforts, we helped them raise over 400,000 euro.
And wow, so this was amazing.
Yeah, this is a very, very unique and specific story. And like no one else was focusing on like this subgroup per se, you know, especially not at the agency level or an organization that had a lot of power and impact. So I'd say that's one of the examples of like such a honed in specific challenge within a particular region and in a horrible time of crisis and war.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And an amazing job to raise 400,000 euro through that campaign, particularly if it was spearheaded by a collective rather than an organization, right? That's a lot of time and effort coming from some individuals to really get that off the ground. That's amazing. Yes. And so the work that you did at RGA was obviously supporting them, giving some creative support to them to get their campaigns running, to create the NFT, presumably in some way. Yeah.
Yes. So the main support that we provided them with was creating of the editorial NFT. So our comms team partnered with the women to write the story, but we also did some branding work, because what was happening in this space is it was very crowded amongst themselves. So there were a lot of Black organizations or just people, individuals who were like trying to raise funds, and it was chaotic. It's a war, right? And so there were also a lot of scams going on, unfortunately, as well. And so we got together one weekend. It was a very intense weekend. It was like our brand design consulting group, some folks, just volunteers coming together. And we created like a very quick MVP brand toolkit for them to provide them with some assets that they could use to promote what they were doing and enhance their like GoFundMe and PayPal fundraisers, which was very successful. They got a lot of media coverage from what they were doing as well. And it did help to rise above the noise and legitimize themselves by aligning with us. Because again, like I was saying, there was a lot of scams and a lot of confusion during that time.
And also this is creative input and expertise and a bit of media expertise that they may well not have had otherwise, right? Unless they just happen to have possess those skills as individuals. So yeah, this is amazing. You must have some great stories from some other businesses and, you know, and entrepreneurs that you've really assisted and that's made a massive difference to them, right?
Yeah, for sure. So for instance, like I was mentioning Founderland, they have been able to raise almost 1.5 million euro, and they've received this in grants from different resources, from Google, from the German government, largely in part from the work that they've been doing for us. So we created a whole new company. They used to be called Tech and Color, but now they're called Founderland. And they have a community of over 400 women of color entrepreneurs all over Europe. And one of our strategies for the Make Good for Businesses program is actually to partner with organizations that are helping like the masses, right? So we're helping this one organization that's helping 400 businesses. And so our impact can be felt like even greater. And they've been able to create programs to get their founders investor ready. To have conversations to get more capital, because, you know, only 0.5% of women-led companies of color get funding from VCs in the first place. And so by working with us and getting this funding, they've been able to go from 0 to 60 in such a short amount of time. So I'm incredibly proud of them.
Amazing. This is fantastic work. I'd love to hear more about it, Beena, but we've run out of time on the podcast, so I'm going to have those conversations with you offline.
Yes.
but thank you so much for making some time for us. First thing in the morning for you over there in New York. It was delightful to have you on the podcast this week. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Rachel, and so nice to meet you, Matt.
And indeed, thank you very much, Matt, for coming on the podcast, allowing me to expose your hobbies to all of our podcast fans.
I feel so revealed and exposed. I was thinking last week, I was actually, when fixing up a piece of furniture, I was listening to a podcast about gaming at the same time. So it's just like mashing them both at the same time.
Combining them. You must have been in heaven.
Oh, I love it so much.
Awesome. Thank you so much for joining me on the podcast, both of you. And thanks, everybody, for listening. That was this week's Mad Tech Podcast.